I'd like to hear, for one thing, more about what you were just saying about how you're, this is a little off the major topic I'm working on immediately, but what you were just saying about how your involvement with the farm worker movement affected the rest of your life.
I came to Arvin, California, as pastor of the First Congregational Church there. In, how's that level, okay?
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
In 19...
I could put this between us and then you'd probably...
Okay.
I just don't want it to be in the way of...
Yeah. In 1963, and the majority of the people of my parish were either in agribusiness or connected with it. Even the vice president of the DiGiorgio Corporation, which was the largest grower around us, was in our church. And the member of and his family. And I didn't know much about the farm worker thing. I knew that there was a lot of agribusiness around and that the community depended upon migrant workers. And I really didn't know anything about it. Knew only the grower's side, of course. And then September 1965 came and Caesar called the strike, all of which we know how that came about. The Filipino farm workers kind of giving a little push and making it happen and so forth. Anyways, I was acquainted with Chris Hartmeyer through the Southern California Conference, and I was president of a community service program we had in Bakersfield called Friendship House. And that's how I got connected to Chris. And after the farm worker strike had started, I don't know how far we were into it. It was in the fall of 65. Chris came to talk to me about it and wanted to know what I thought about it. I said, I don't know a thing about it. No, I know what the growers tell me. Growers see this as just agitation. It happens from time to time, and violence occurs on both sides. And I was really ignorant about the whole situation. So he said, would you come over and sometime and meet Caesar and hear the other side? And I said, of course. So that's how it started. He took me over to meet Caesar when they were in the little pink stucco house, and meeting in the Filipino hall. And I went Friday evenings to the strike meetings, and I went out in the picket line and watched what they did and listened. And I got that side of it. And then I knew that there was something more to it than just what the organizers had said. I had to see what was the problems. So I made it my business to go out and visit some of the farm worker labor camps where they live. And that's when my mind began to shift dramatically, when I saw not simply poverty, but just injustice and deprivation of a kind I've never seen. And I'd seen, worked in the slums and in the ghettos, but this was awesome. The farm labor camp that was just outside of Arvin, which is the one John Steinbeck wrote about in Grades of Wrath, was the same as when he wrote about it in 1940. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing changed. There were corrugated iron places, houses, and water outside, and I don't think there were lights. Just nasty, just rotten conditions. And I helped a group from UCLA come up and do work in that labor camp that summer. And in fact, two of them stayed with us in our house, and I spread the other kids around the community. And they just did reading, writing, arithmetic, and recreation, kind of daycare stuff with the kids in the farm labor camp. Then I knew my next step was I had to, after seeing all that, getting not only around Arvin, but Mendota and all the little places around there, I began to get around and see some of the labor camps and how terrible they were. I decided I better go out and see it firsthand. So I let my beard grow for 2-3 days, put on some old clothes, and borrowed an old pickup truck of one of my rancher friends, and drove out the fields in the morning and got a job. I picked peas first day. I worked my buns off, I thought, because I knew I didn't have to do it for day after day after day. I think I made $1.78 that day. And I remember the guys down the field a little bit selling pot for 50 cents a bottle, which, you know, was five times what it cost, and gambling going on, and the farm workers having to squat over here when they had to, you know, go to the bathroom and that sort of thing. And the next day I picked beans or something. And then one time I went out in the field and picked grapes. We also had tomatoes down there, in there around Arvin, and I picked tomatoes. And people were paid in cash. As soon as they brought their crate in and dumped it, the guy laid out silver in their hands, and of course there were no, obviously, good records being kept for the farm worker, farmers. And what used to bother me was the rows of old cars and old trucks along the side of the fields, and I walked by them and children sleeping in the back, little kids, babies, you know. But, well, the other kids that could walk were out of the fields with the farm workers. Well, I knew this wasn't right, and it began to bother me, the injustice of it, and the powerlessness of the farm workers. And I knew that the church had to make some response to it, because the church historically is on the side of the weak and where there's injustice, to try to balance it. I have a very strong feeling about the role of the pastor in the pulpit, because I recognize the pulpit's a monologue and I got a captive audience. So I wasn't going to use that as a haranguer place. So I formed Wednesday night town meetings and got growers and got farm worker representatives. Caesar came and Chris and others, not Caesar, but other members of the farm worker community came, and like a debate. But I was just shocked with the reaction of my folks, that they didn't want a debate. They said there isn't the other side, because those are just communists and agitators and hippies. And I was really rather floored by it. The trustees had come kind of unglued out of their seats, you know, kind of like fascists. I couldn't believe it. And I hadn't taken any position one or the other, but the more they pushed, the more lies they began to tell me about how it really is, you know, how poor we really are compared to farm workers. I knew that something was wrong. And then when I found out that the chairman of my trustees found out that one of his foremen, who was a Mexican-American, was helping Caesar organize in the field, he fired him, gave him 24 hours to get out of his house. And the guy went to the town to fetch his wife and his children. While he was in town, the chairman of a board of trustees set his house on fire and burned it to the ground. I thought, that really turned me over the hill. I just said, my stars, come on, what's wrong here? So I just kept up my concern, and so I went out on the picket line with the folks and went in the marches with the people. I didn't push my church. I tried to get more conversation and debate on it. It wasn't possible. Some were scared, whose lives were tied into agribusiness. Some were absolutely closed minded. Some had this repeated slogan of the separation of church and state, you know, which to me was meaningless. Then one day my board of deacons came in to see me, and they said, we've noticed in your pastoral prayers lately that you've been praying about the agribusiness situation and the strike, and praying for farm workers and for growers, which I did. You know, I gave equal time. They said, we don't want you to mention it anymore. It's not really an issue that has anything to do with the church. And we certainly don't want you to mention the farm workers anymore, because that's not a Christian issue, that's a communist issue. And I said, well, gentlemen, that's now, meaning we've come to the parting of the ways. And the next week I resigned. If they were going to suggest that there are some people you pray for and some that you don't, some that are worthy and some that are unworthy, and this is what you can do in the pulpit, and this is what you can't do, then I had to make a personal decision. So I made the personal decision. And I left within 2 months, and I put my name in for a job that was opening had opened up in Fresno with the Council of Churches, executive director of the Council of Churches. It was a shaky operation. The last guy left 3-4 months behind in his salary and whatnot. But I was hungry. We needed a job, and they had a farm worker. They had a market ministry staff person, Dick Sample, who was a UCC minister.
Very, very well.
Dick's a great guy.
He worked with my husband in Mendota.
Oh, that's where they lived, of course. Yeah, and then we had the community center out there.
Mm-hmm.
And George Ballas, who was the photographer, mm-hmm. and
George.
A lot of the wonderful things happened out there in Mendota.
When did you go with the Fresno Council?
1967. And I was with them 2 years, and the community center we had out there in Mendota, of course, we allowed it to be used for farm worker organizing, and of course, we had 55 churches that were involved in the Council of Churches. And we had what amounts to a giver's strike. One church after another quit their payments to the Council of Churches. And finally, we just ran out of money, and I, of course, couldn't work, and so we voted to close. And we kept one little Oregon Open. We did some other things too. We organized, did some work in the drug culture and so forth in the community. But I went door to door with my kids in West Fresno with petitions against Safeway and that sort of thing, and so did a lot of members of the churches. My church, Joanne and I belonged to, was the College Community United Church of Christ. Henry Hayden was pastor there. The last church in town that related to farm workers, even letting them come in and sleep when they were coming into a place to do some organizing to sleep in the fellowship hall and whatnot. They were great.
This is the one up by Cal State, LA?
Yeah.
By Cal State?
Fresno State. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
College Avenue mm-hmm. Church, I think it's called. But the Lutherans, the other, our other two congregational churches, I mean, one of them just never gave us any support. And the large and first congregational church, which is the largest church in town, their minister and their congregation came out name-calling of me and the council of churches and the farm workers and whatnot. The guy's name was Lawrence. I remember a red-headed man.
Was Jean Boutillier still on the staff at first?
Jean had just left.
He just left.
Yep. Yep. Guy came on there afterwards. What was his name? He's the pastor up north now. So I had no support in town, and when that thing folded up, God bless the English department of Fresno State. I said, if I'm going to go out, I want to go out with a lot of noise. So I called a press conference, and all of the TV stations came. And I told the reasons why we're being bombed out, and called name names. The Catholics had been helpful. Bishop Manning, who came in, there was no Cardinal Manning in L.A., had auxiliary bishop who is now the Bishop of Fresno.
Mahoney.
Roger Mahoney.
Yeah. He's now the bishop in Los Angeles.
Oh, he's in L.A.?
Yeah, he's the new one there.
Well, Roger was helpful, although very careful. He was pastor at the time of a little, I think, Chinese church in West Fresno, which is where the ghetto is, black as well as Chicano. And Roger was helpful, and as a matter of fact, we got our offices moved out to the Roman Catholic headquarters. We had a nice suite of offices out there through Roger's help, and he introduced me to the bishop, and the bishop was very helpful and allowed his priests and the ladies, the nuns, to participate, although didn't go out on a big limb himself and make a lot of racket. So I worked at in the English department, and then while the speech department asked me to do a couple of things, so I took on a couple of jobs there. So between the English and the speech department, I had a full-time job. And I began to worry that we were now getting close to 1970, and now union contracts were being signed, that all this history was being lost. And so decided to take on a master's program and I'm doing a master's degree in contemporary rhetoric, which is in the speech department, and I'd make Cesar Chavez my topic and look at the speaking of Cesar Chavez. And I did a comparison between him and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and nonviolence.
I read your book.
Yep. Out of that grew an idea, we got to get some primary sources in the library. And that's when I got a $1,500 grant from the school to do a special collections. And I spent a year working on that and put it in the library. What you say now is lost. I think it's fascinating. Anyway, at the end of 2 years, 1970, it was time for me. The speech department offered me a full-time track tenure job. All those things have to go by the president's office. Mm-hmm. Right at that time, we had a riot out of Fresno State. A kid threw a Molotov cocktail through a window and hit the computer square. In those days, they had the computer where everybody could get at it. Now all the computers, of course, are in basements. Anyways, it burned the computer down $1 million to the ground. So they have police everywhere. Armed guards walked, bodyguards walked with it. The old president resigned, and this new guy came in who was a minister, but a banker. Minister turned banker. Real arch-conservative guy. Chained the door of the chairman's department of the English department, who was kind of a radical guy, neat guy. Anyway, my tenure thing came across his desk. He called me in alone and said, you're not going to have this. And he said, I know what kind of work you're doing. You're interested in Cesar Chavez. We don't want any of that crap in this school. I'm denying your tenure. Okay. He had the power. The speech department fought it, but it was, you know, he had that power. So I was done. So there was a third job, gone. And then I got up here in another church, and then the rest is just history. But as a result of all that, to answer your question that you started with, it took a long time to make a historical comment. The thing that happened to me was not only a sensitivity to those like farm workers, to those on the bottom end of the scale, but a rage, which I'd never experienced before. I was born and raised in New England, son of a minister, grandson of a minister, where decorum and right order of worship and decency and calm and so forth is the order of the day. And one does not raise his voice or lose his temper. And I saw conditions so awful, and people who were the pillars of the churches letting it happen. That dichotomy just floored me. I said, at least the church and the Christian faith has got to help raise the balance, identify with the weak until they are up at least at an even keel so they can do battle with the big giant, which is agribusiness. The little farmers, I had several of those in churches and places I served. While publicly they opposed it, privately they did not, because they were having just as hard a time as the farmer. It's the little guys. It was, you know, this Southern Pacific and Safeway and all these people tied in that own that San Joaquin Valley, of course. That's where the money is. But a sensitivity and rage together have remained with me from that day until now. Cesar Chavez forever influenced my life. I've got dozens of tapes which someday I'll collate from his speeches, listening to him, which of course he gets up without notes, from 1965 when I first heard him up until 1972, then I kind of dropped out of things. And that kind of humility, that insistence on nonviolence, his fasting, and his own personal history also was an inspiration to me. And I knew, and Caesar knew and said it, that in his lifetime this battle would not be done, and that they would have to do it over again. And here they are. Contracts come up for re-ratification, and they're not being re-ratified. They're having to fight all over again. You know, it's with this new governor, of course, the power shifted again back to agribusiness. Yes. He's effectively cut out all the recourses they had. So my life now has focused in the direction of places for justice. And while it might not be farm workers here in Oakland, because housing and unemployment is the big problem here, and crime and dope and jails, those kinds of things, which I wouldn't have gotten involved in because of my background and my training in seminary. But because of those 5 years in the valley, connected with the farm workers, my life and my family's life, because the kids went on the picket line, so did my wife. And Joanne did volunteer work in the summer and teaching. She's a school teacher. And I remember walking with our little son Andrew, who was 4, and the two of us going door to door and getting petitions against Safeway, people not to shop at Safeway. It forever touched their lives, too, about a sense of moral justice in the world with people. And while I'm not in those battles now, like I was then, there is always and forever within me a deep restlessness and a recognition that we have business undone and that the church is not only not on the forefront but fallen further behind than we were back in the 60s. We are not there where the people are and have the need. And I'll be damned if I know how to get them into it. I saw in this conference that I'm a part of now, the fact that this conference related to Caesar and the farm worker movement cost them dearly, and we're still paying for it. We lost membership and money, and people still talk about the farm worker movement. One of my deacons here, 3 years after I'd been here as pastor, somehow found out that I wrote a book on the farm worker movement. He said, boy, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have voted for him, but he came, just because I wrote a book. I never read the book. But, you know, so that mindset still exists, that prejudice, and that that distrust and that belief that this is a communist, you know, conspiracy there. I remember battles going to churches with Chris to debate. They'd have somebody from Farm Bureau and they'd have Chris or me and debate. And hear the church people get up and ask questions. I thought I was in a Nazi youth rally. I just couldn't believe the church, the way they, the hatred latent in people that came pouring out of them. And it still mystifies me. Because it was based on ignorance. They didn't know the people. I'd ask people, when's the last time you went to a labor camp? All those people don't mind it. They're gypsy-like. They like it. They like that carefree life. Oh my Lord, you could. The first three people you talked to were farm workers. Wouldn't say that. None of them didn't like it. They were dying. You know, life expectancy was 38. Kids are unhealthy and poor education. You know, I got our amazing thing happened in Arvin. Our Women's Society president was coming home from Bakersfield one day and ran across an old car and a trailer broken down. And obviously a farm worker family, man, woman, although not Mexican, and eight children, and the wife is this pregnant, big, huge wife. Broke down, flat tire, car, truck. She just mentioned it to me. She lived across the street. So I drove out there to see what the matter was. Mm-hmm. And I had a little discretionary fund. This was after I got started getting involved in the farm worker thing. He was looking for work, so I paid to have him hauled into a trailer camp and got him three or four nights lodging in a trailer camp. And then helped him get out to where the fields were, and his wife and some of his older kids. Make a long story short, I got the church to adopt the family, which is probably one of the reasons they all got mad at me finally. Because we got a house, we rented it. It was a nasty house with cockroaches everywhere, and then those little old ladies in there cleaning it out for all those kids, and they got cribs and clothes, and we adopted this family. Albert Pickett was his name. He couldn't read or write. I helped him get his driver's license, just learning the signs by sight and by memory. At the end of 9 months, one day I was over there, he just looked at me kind of sadly and said, well, I hear they're paying good money for apple picking up in Washington. I'm going to move. And I said, Albert, you're just getting into community, you know. And he says, I know I should stay, and I want to stay, but something's pulling me out. There's more money up there. I know there is. And that's been the story of Albert's life and his father before him. They kept going from place to place, believing there was going to be more money and a better way of life, and of course it was always worse. So he just packed everything in the station wagon with those now 10 kids, and off he went to Washington. 6 months later, I heard from him that he was in jail someplace in the South, and he needed $120 bail, and I sent it to him. And that's the last I ever heard of him. But the church really felt they got stung. They put all this money and all this effort and said, see, well, with one family, for almost a year, we gave them a sense of belonging and a sense of caring, and food was brought in and clothing, and, you know, we adopted them. But it didn't work that way for the most of the church. They said, well, you see. And it didn't work with that family. But it was a start. But that just helped me just feel very deeply inside that the church wasn't so much nasty as it was out of its element and just timid and fearful. And, of course, I remember my chairman, my Sunday school superintendent, who was a school administrator, said, I can't say a word even though I feel for you and the farm worker thing. He said, because the school board is all ranchers. I'd lose my job if I said anything. And it was a genuine fear, you know. And I suppose what also amalgamated me and the family was in Fresno, things began to get nasty. We got threatening phone calls in the middle of the night. Cars driving by at night, throwing garbage in our driveway. And one night a gun shot at us driving our truck. A bullet went through the back. And then I knew, my word, what kind of people are we dealing with, you know? Because the only people I was relating to were church people and some of agribusiness. But their response was to threaten me and my family, which didn't turn us off and made us a lot more careful. But it convinced me all the more that if they're working that hard to silence everybody, there must be something out there. And of course there was. Look, the farm labor camps around Fresno. You know, just awesome. Terrible places. So.
So the farm worker movement, it sounds like, really allowed you an opportunity to become deeply equated with one justice struggle in a way that really brought justice issues alive, that you then have a, by transference, can better understand
precisely
all these other places.
Yeah. Yeah. After the farm worker thing failed, we got involved with the Tenants Council, which was a black issue in West Fresno. And as a matter of fact, while I was looking for a job, I took on an interim in the Second Baptist Church, which is an all-black church, and I was the pastor there for a while. I had a great time. But it was out of that, because the blacks supported the farm worker movement. They supported Caesar. The poor black people, they were some of our strongest advocates and organizers. So as a consequence, after I moved aside from the farm worker thing, I went right into the Tenants Council and got into to housing, justice and housing in West Fresno for folks. And that was, that's exactly what happened. It was a very easy transition to make. And I went to the 40 Acres, and I went down to see Caesar while he was on his fast, and all those other sorts of things. And that forever, to say it in human words, that forever touched my conscience, but it touched my soul and touched my very being. It's not something you could get in seminary. It is not something you can get out of any textbook or seminars. It's something that just happened to me. And I know if anything, even like a small matter, the other day I was in a group of people in our church. I was doing a Bible study and someone said, "What do you think the colored really want?" I said, "What did you say? What do you think the colored really want? Did you hear what you said?" Now, years ago, I wouldn't have said anything. I've been embarrassed, but I would have passed by. And I said, "Colored's not a word you use anymore." "Oh, what do you use?" I said, "Black." Okay, well, then we went on. But before, just small matters like that would pass right by me, or nigger, or anything, or any of the other things, you know, where people are labeled. Now, that immediately turns something on. That even if it's just to correct somebody's vocabulary, that's part of it. And if I can't be on a picket line now, there are things that I can do here when I see things like that. And so that's what's happened to me. And while there was a rage built up within me because of the injustice, which probably came, one, because I was affected by the awful poverty and the awful pain and whatnot what was going on. Also, my sense of helplessness of being able to do anything about it. I certainly couldn't move the church. We couldn't find a single church in the whole San Joaquin Valley, and that's a lot of land, a lot of churches, who would come out and make a statement, or there would be individuals within the churches, and individual ministers that we had in a little group, but not a single one. And largely, it wasn't because they were nasty people, because I know them, like Bill Du, you know, it's because they were fearful, you know, and you do put your head out and make a noise and something's going to happen to you, and it did. And I don't know, but I suspect it still would.
Yes.
In that same valley, in those same places, nothing's changed, you know. The health laws come in, it's a little more, you know, now in the fields you can see portable toilets out there that weren't there in 1965, you know, big deal. And there are not so many kids, but some of the kids are working.
And in other areas.
Right, so I'm in Florida. I'm down to visit my mother not long ago.
Worse.
Sure.
And over in the Salinas area, some of the conditions I understand there are worse than they were even in the 60s.
Sure.
Tell me about the, with the Fresno Council of Churches, you had lost all of this financial support,
mm-hmm.
and then there was a meeting, and then there was a vote whether to stay in business or not. So tell me exactly how that all happened.
Board of Directors, without making any statements about, you know, all the reasons why, just said simply because we don't have money to run the operation, they just voted to close it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it, the excuse or the statement given by the Board of Directors was that due to lack of finances, because they came to the point where they couldn't pay my salary, other than we had a secretary. And of course we had Dick Sample was on our staff too. Poor Dick. And his wife lived on such a shoestring, my stars out there. And as everybody did, you know. But we also had there was a kind of a renaissance in the late 60s in Fresno. They had a neat mayor named Floyd Hyde, Republican. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he got called to be undersecretary to HUD. And that only lasted 3 or 4 years, and he came back. Now he's a lawyer practicing up here in San Francisco somewhere. Floyd was a great mayor and an open supporter of the farm worker movement. Mm-hmm. And so while he was mayor, and he was Republican, a lot of things happened, and we did a lot of things together. And when Martin Luther King was assassinated, the mayor helped put together things and did proclamations for farm workers and whatnot. He was a really good guy. And all this was happening, and that's when the Council of Churches, its dying moment. We did a coffee house ministry, and we rented the Sun Main Raisin warehouse, which was 40,000 square feet, and had counseling for kids on drugs and arts and crafts and dances and all kinds of things for the teenagers of Fresno. Got a lot of flack for that. But we tried to do a lot of relevant ministries, which are spin-offs, even then, of the what was going on with the farm workers. How does the church together engage in justice programs? Mm-hmm. You know.
Chris wrote in The Church, the Emerging Farm Worker Movement in 67, that he talks to, with all the community watching through the mass media, the council had a do-or-die delegate assembly and chose to live. It was, in fact, a rebirth. And then there, I have a real neat quote from you about that. So was there one period where you took a vote and went on for a while, and then the funds were just so...
Yep. The individual churches began to drop out, and significantly, of course, the individual churches, like First Baptist, First Congregational, who are big contributors, would just take a few of them, and then, you know, it's like if America went out of the UN, that put a dent in it that they probably couldn't survive. And so some of the significant churches went out first, and that's when our funding went out. Mm-hmm. But we had delegate assemblies, where we made resolutions, and you find some of those in these documents, mm-hmm. where we're on record supporting the farm workers and their right to organize. Always being careful, though, you know. The churches are very careful about the language, so that in a resolution supporting farm workers, you'd also support growers, you know. They had to do that. But they were coming from a grower viewpoint. Many of them involved in it or dependent upon it themselves, you see. Mm-hmm. But that little program out in Mendota we had with the community center was really a very active thing. It became, of course, the focal point for organization of Caesar. That's where all the organizing took place. And food was collected, and clothing, and the churches really got into that, because that's easy, you know, to give food and give clothing and to help kids. Mm-hmm. But then when it moved beyond that, and they were having strike meetings at the community center, that's, of course, when people began to get nervous and then, of course, get negative. Our summer programs are very popular because... You know, here we were giving Band-Aids, of course, what it amounted to. The farm workers, kids were there, the youngest ones that couldn't work in the field, so we provided little programs for them. And clothing, and boxes of food. That was easy. And then when you found out they worked for Caesar, then you burned their house down, you know, like my chairman did.
You know, I was in...
But yeah, that was the same thing for me. This is the formative time when our kids were all young, all babies, four of them. We're close together. And we started in a small church, and then I started as a Methodist, mm-hmm. and then went UCC. And the Methodists always start you in some little agricultural place,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
as they did.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, our first church was in Bardsdale, which is near Fillmore, really, down in Ventura County, and the citrus groves. And the Bracero thing was exploding. And... everybody in my church, we lived in the middle of Orange Groves, our church, and in fact, the church had property in the Orange Groves, and every single member of the church, except the school teachers, were growers. And I totally identified with the growers, of course, you know, the Bracero program and these wetbacks coming across and all this kind of thing. And they took me to see the housing, and it was dormitory style for men and looked clean, and you know, I didn't think anything of it. So I hadn't had anything until we went over the hill of the Grapevine and down in San Joaquin Valley. And that's another planet. That was for me. That was the educating of me. That was the theological training I didn't have in seminary. Mm-hmm. Was right there out in those fields. Because you drive along the freeway, of course, and it's wonderful, lovely, beautiful fields. You can't see those labor camps. And it's right, like the prisons. We build them off in the boonies so you can't see them. In fact, it's hard to get to them. And in fact, I had to find out where they were through farm workers.
Yes.
Because the growers wouldn't tell you, because they owned them.
Right.
And it's like people who own houses that say, well, we fix them up and they make them dirty. They don't mind living in felt,
Oh, Jesus.
It was the radicalizing of us and the sensitizing of us in a way that, as I say, I don't know what directions or interests my ministry would have taken hadn't I not been through that experience. I'd probably stayed on with the Methodists and gone up the ladder, so to speak, as they do, Mm-hmm. And now...
So that had something to do with your changing UCC?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, precisely. I want to be in a congregational system where there's more democracy and not a hierarchy.
Mm.
Yeah. It had a lot to do with me going to UCC. And had a lot to do with me having the freedom to be able to step out of the ministry and not say, well, I've blown it, I can't be a minister, I'm a failure. When I lost the Council of Churches job, I went right into teaching, and I felt that was a good ministry. Mm-hmm. And I came up here, and I for 3.5 years, directed a retreat center out in Calaveras County. And then after that, went in the Merchant Marine for 5 years, put on a uniform. And that was easier, I think, as a result of the farm worker thing, for me to move into other kinds of ministry. Because I think ministry is anything you do that service to people, mm-hmm, and service to the structures of society and changing it. Mm-hmm. And that's why there are ordained ministers and there are other ministers. I think all of us who are Christians are called to be ministers. So it gave me the freedom to make decisions about it. I worked for CBS for a year, did a radio job. Well, I loved it. And I got in trouble. I lost that job ultimately because I got Chris on and a few people, and it was a talk show and the people would call up, why you got these communists on the roof,
Where was that?
Fresno. I worked for KFRE for a year. I had the radio name of George Bancroft and had a radio talk show.
You just don't learn, do you?
No. That's the other thing. I don't learn.
Oh, it's been so good of you to do this, and I don't want to keep you sitting too long.
I gotta say, I'm too